Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Spring is in the air. Trees are leafing out. Flowers are sprouting. The azaleas are blooming. And the pollen is popping. Time for gardeners to get to work. There's a lot to do, but there's also a lot to know. And we have thousands of relative newcomers to America's favorite pastime. Their numbers grew exponentially during the pandemic. Many have stuck with it. And since this is a time-consuming hobby, which can also be expensive, success is paramount. And we have gathered a panel of experts to help you toward that end. They know what plants grow best in this region. They can talk about soil and composting, even how to incorporate animals into your gardening efforts. But whether you have room for that on your suburban plot of land or you just have a couple of window boxes on an apartment balcony, we have you covered. Aaron Hostetler is a local gardener and owner of The Patio Farmer, which focuses on growing food in small places. Cherie Jazar is also a local gardener, farmer, and owner of Deep Roots CPS Farm, which specializes in growing fruits and vegetables, but also beekeeping and incorporating animals like goats and chickens. And Mary Roberts is owner of Windcrest Farms in Monroe, a family farm which has preserved and nurtured their land organically since 1978. Good morning. Welcome back to the program to all three of you. Nice to have you here. We have to stop meeting only in the springtime. We should get together and grow poinsettias.
Last fall.
Oh, that's what we did. You're right. I'm going to start with you, Mary, if I have this right. We had a slightly warmer, slightly drier winter than if you compare it to historical averages. I think temperatures were about 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average. Precipitation was about 6 inches, with only about an inch of that falling as snow. So what does that mean for soils, for insects, for spring planting? Anything at all?
It means a lot. Although the averages were a little warmer, we noticed that the nighttime temperatures were actually cooler and started much, much earlier in 2024 than in years past. Usually we're not burning propane in the greenhouses until about January, February. We started early December. So the nighttime temperatures were a little colder. And there's some good and there's some bad to that. The good is some of our plants require a number of chill hours in order to produce either beautiful blossoms or fruit. The bad news was that propane in the greenhouse. We did have to heat a little bit more this year. So, you know, with everything, it's a mixed bag. We could use some more rain. Not like the intense stuff we had last night, but a couple of days of just some slow, steady rain would really set us up for the hot summer coming.
I'm glad you mentioned the colder than normal nights, because when I was thinking about what the winter was like, and actually I had a conversation about this from somebody from out of town yesterday, I thought, well, it was a colder winter than normal. And then I looked up the facts, and that didn't turn out to be, except perhaps at night, and that's what I remembered. Cherie, some areas of the country, the Midwest, the South in particular, often have these false springs where we are in the winter, but suddenly it's 70, 75 degrees, and the trees get fooled, and some of the flowers get fooled, and then suddenly, just like that, we're back to winter. Did we experience that this year at all?
Oh, most definitely. We had some super warm days in January and February, which caused a lot of the things that I had already put out in the fields to get to thinking spring was here, and some growth came, and then boom, frost. And you know, one of the things that you got to think about as gardening is really patience, especially in the early parts of the year, January, February, even in March, where you really think it's time to get out there and till around in the soil and get things ready. But You don't want to do that because, or you want to have a plan when you do that because that could happen. It could go really from quickly being very cold, then warm again, and then a frost. So yes, that did happen. We had some early blooms and things, but all in all, it wasn't bad. But that typically happens, but not so drastic. And I think that happened early this year.
And it's been my impression that we can have frosts up till April the 15th, although I looked that up too yesterday. And the average last frost in this area is April the 5th, which is 5 days from now. And I looked up on my weather app on my phone what it was going to be like at night for the next 14 days, and there are no temperatures below 41 degrees. So are we out of the woods, Mary, with regard to frost? Is frost over for this part of the year?
Not necessarily. We as gardeners, farmers, we're always on that weather app looking at the 10-day. And I jumped on one and I said, well, let's see what April in the hole looks like. And the end of April, they said we could dip down into an overnight low of 27. And I've been on this property for 48 years. I can remember. We thought it was summer, and then early May get a little nip. But as Cherie had mentioned, if you have a plan, you're willing to go out and cover plants, protect them from that blip here at the end of spring, then feel free to do that extra work. But I want people to remember that it's not just the air temperature that we're concerned about, it is the soil temperature. And the soil is may not be sufficiently warm for some of the things that we really love to grow, like tomatoes and basil and cucumbers and that kind of thing. So just as yesterday's rain cleared off some of the pollen, which we love, it was also a cool rain. If you walked outside this morning, there's definitely a crisp to the air, and that cool rain will lower the temperature of soil.
And soil temperature would seem to me, Aaron, to be even more important to people who plant things in small containers like flower pots or window boxes or even some raised beds, because that soil is not in the ground, it's above the ground. Do you have to take extra precautions in this part of the year if you've already started planting in those containers?
That's a great question. I think that there is a chance. I mean, it's a different kind of environment to grow in a smaller space. And when you have less resources for your plants, they can be a little more susceptible to those swings in temperature and conditions. My rule of thumb when planting summer vegetables that are sensitive to frosts and freezes is to wait really until like the end of April, early May is when I like to plant my tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, all of those. But I do have clients who are planting those things now, which I coach them through. Like, this is what you need to be aware of, and the different things to keep in mind because, as we have talked about, temperature is a big consideration.
Well, if you plant them in pots, that you can bring the pots, they're not enormous. You could bring the pots indoors if it's going to be, we're going to have a cold snap, I would think. But let me ask you a question about that, because a lot of people do bring their stuff inside for the winter because they want some of these things to be available all winter long, and then they put them back out in the spring. When a plant has become acclimated to indoor temperatures and humidity levels, and you put it outside, does it go through a period of shock? Should you prepare the plant in any way to put it back out?
Yes, you should. And if anyone has started seeds inside over the winter, this would also pertain to that. But our indoor climate, if you will, is very different than the outdoor climate. And the plants that have been inside over the winter, they can experience a little bit of shock if you just take them directly outside and you leave them out there. So, what a lot of us will do, and what I would recommend doing, is gradually hardening off. That's what the process is called. It's hardening off your plants or getting them used to the outdoors. So that could look like a few hours on a bright sunny day outside, and then coming back inside at night if it's going to be super chilly. And by super chilly, I mean, less than 50 degrees or even 60 degrees. And then just repeating that process, but gradually increasing the exposure of your plants outside before you just leave them out for the or plant them or do whatever you're going to do with them.
So scattered throughout the program, I want to bring in some listener questions. And we've it's kind of salted the pot a bit by putting this out on social media yesterday. So we have some questions in the bag already. But if you'd like a question answered, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And one of those emails has already come in. If we do get another frost or another chilly night, what is the best way to protect things that are already in the ground? Who would like to take that?
I'll take it.
Mary, go ahead.
Yes. So we can trap any heat that may be stored in the soil to provide like a cushion of warm air by covering the plants. Now, there are products that you can buy called roll covers or plant blankets. Sometimes you see them marketed as at that. And they're not necessarily a very heavy covering because, of course, we don't want to crush plants over under the weight. But sometimes when you get a cold night and drive through the neighborhood, you'll see sheets draped across a lot of plants that people are trying to keep that frost off the plant. And there are other things, particularly for tomatoes. There's a product called Wall of Water that's a container that you fill with water. Water warms quicker than air, and you surround the plants. A homemade version might be a milk jug that you fill with water and allow it to warm during the day with the sun, and then that warmth is released back out. All of those things are work, and for a dedicated gardener that's just got to have that first tomato of the season, that's worth the effort. But as the other two ladies have said, and I totally agree, patience is a virtue. If you just wait till the conditions are right, what I plant in May will outproduce what you plant in March because the conditions are right. If they are not sitting there, when you and I get chilled, we kind of draw in and we huddle up, and then it takes us a while to warm up. Our plants are the same thing. Wait until the conditions are right, they hit the ground running, and you will get an early crop.
Well, that was going to lead into my next question because we've been talking about people who've already put things in the ground and how to protect those plants and when to do it. And you just said that you'll have a bigger crop if you wait until May. So, Cherie, for those who have waited, who have not yet put things in the ground, what kinds of things, if any, should you be doing right now to get the ground, the soil, ready to receive whatever it is you want to grow?
So I think what Mary just said is ideal. I want to build on that just a minute before I answer your question.
Sure.
Sometimes we forget that there are some plants that are just warm weather plants and some that are cold tolerant plants or vegetables. And we skip right over spring and we jump right into summer with planting in our gardens. So I think, I have this tool, I mean, this thing about ready in 30. In springtime, so I plant things like radishes and arugula and greens in my garden as the spring crop.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break and we'll pick up on the other side of the break in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gardening. Springtime is here. It's time to think about this. If you're a gardener or want to be one, Mary Roberts joins us. She's the owner of Windcrest Farms. Aaron Hostetler is a local gardener and owner of The Patio Farmer for small container farming and more. And Cherie Jazar is a local gardener, farmer, owner of Deep Roots CPS Farm. And I had to interrupt you, Cherie, in the middle of an answer. You were talking about ready in 30 or something. I think that was what you called it, and to how to get ready to actually start planting. So pick up where you left off.
Well, to summarize what I was saying before, it's like start with cold hardy crops in the spring, you know, things like kales and arugula. You can even do some collards and spinach. These things are leafy greens and they thrive in colder soil. So start there if you're planning your garden. But in order to get your soil ready, which is what we want to do, you know, the first thing is test the soil. Like, don't just start guessing and throwing amendments in there. We want to test our soil, whatever, if it's in ground or in a pot, to know the pH, to know the nutrients that are in there. And then I do something. I compost like a boss, right? I add organic matter to my soil to feed it, to jumpstart that spring growth that's going to come in May. I do that to try to get the environment ready for whatever I want to plant. So I think those two things I would suggest as a starter for your spring garden.
So when you talk about getting your soil tested for its pH and other nutrients that are in the soil itself, how do you do that? Where do you do that? Are there home kits or do you have to go to your extension agent to do that?
So there are home kits that you can get from gardening stores and big box stores have them. I think even some of your local, big box stores have them. But the extension, the North Carolina Cooperative Extension here in Mecklenburg County and many counties have soil testing kits that you can send off, I believe, before December. That's free, but it's nominal cost. But it will help you understand the basic nutrient level and pHs in your soil. And it helps you to identify where to plant what type of crop. So yeah, there's a local extension that can help you. And then you can get your own home kits from the store.
Aaron, does that apply to people who are gardening on their patio balcony, on their balconies or their patios where, and they're putting things in containers? Or do you just go to a store and you buy potting soil? Will that do it? Tell me what give me your rule of thumb for that.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So generally, potting soil or a bagged soil usually does not need to be tested. Usually, and I say usually because I've had situations where I've bought potting soil, filled a whole raised bed or container, and it turned out to be super out of whack nutritionally. So it is possible, but typically potting soil is ready to grow, right? You don't need to worry about the nutrients. There is something, if you want to look for this when you're shopping for potting soil, on the back of the bag is, on a high quality bag of potting soil, is a guaranteed analysis. And what that is it's a breakdown of all of the nutrients that are in that bag. It's guaranteed, you know, to be in that bag of soil by the soil company. So if you can find a bag of soil that has that guaranteed analysis, not all of them do, but the best ones do, then that is just a level of a reassurance, right? That you're getting.
Let me ask you this. Are the best ones the name brands or the more expensive ones? Is there a correlation to that? Or is it simply something that you find over time and you read the bag and you understand, well, this is pretty good. I'll buy this, even though it's cheaper than the name brand.
Yeah. So I definitely believe that you get out of your soil what you put into it. Mm-hmm. And a higher quality bag of soil is typically reflected in the price. So not choosing the least expensive soil, and, you know, in my experience, the more you spend on your soil, the better your plants do, the more productive your plants are going to be. You know, you have to think too, if you're growing in a small space, even a raised bed, which is a confined space, that your resources are limited. If you're not growing in the ground, you don't have as much nutrients and as as much for your plants to pull from. So it's even more important for you to start off and give your plants a solid foundation by choosing a high quality soil.
So let's talk about water, Mary. We had, I think, 6 inches of precipitation over the winter. I don't know what it's been since the spring started. We had really heavy rains for a brief amount of time, several times yesterday. I don't know how helpful that is because it just kind of floods everything and then goes into the gutters. But let's talk about water. How much should you water? How little should you water? What times of day should you be providing water to the plant, etc.? And is it plant dependent?
Well, it is plant dependent, and it, of course, it's weather dependent. But we have a rule of that we teach the students that come to the farm for classes, and we say you want to water a lot. Don't water a little, a lot. Water a lot, a little. Okay, so what that means is when you water, you want to really apply enough water to get deep into the root zone, give that plant a resource to go deep for. If you water a little, a lot, what you're doing is just training those roots to be at the surface because they say, oh, well, Mary's going to be here at 5 o'clock after work. This is her ritual. She's going to sprinkle the plants a little bit, enjoy us, and then go away. And then Mary goes on vacation and is not there at 5 o'clock to give the little drink, and our plants suffer. So we want to water a lot, a little, not a little, a lot.
And we have a question from an emailer. Can you provide some irrigation tips? Well, that's one right there, I suppose. But recommendations for ground drip line systems and recommendations for using rainwater. Anybody have any tips in that direction?
I can continue with the water.
Okay. All right.
Rainwater is fantastic. One of the reasons that rainwater is so good is that when it does fall through the atmosphere, it's gathering nitrogen. And nitrogen is one of the things that plants need to grow and thrive. Whereas if we're using treated water, like your city water, it has been treated, it's been chlorinated, it's, I don't know all the process, but we know it's been treated. So rainwater brings the bonus of a nutrient as well as the economy of not having to pay for that water coming out of the tap. There are lots of different kits for drip line irrigation. When we are delivering water directly to the root zone, that's more efficient both for the economy of the water and for the plant. It's consistent. And like I said, there's lots of different kits both online and through the big box stores. I know our friend Erin here has put in a lot of systems. She's very good at designing those for home gardeners. So there are resources.
So let's talk about that, Erin, since you've done it many times. Are you putting in and recommending drip irrigation, or what are you recommending?
Yeah, my biggest recommendation for irrigation and watering is that you try to get the emitters or the little sprayers to be as close to the base of the plant and the soil as possible. I personally do a lot of direct seeding. So I plant seeds in the soil as opposed to starting seeds and then transplanting them. I do a lot of transplanting as well. But when I'm starting seeds, I like for there to be a spray, right? So I'm reaching a wider radius of my growing space, of my soil surface, from the top down. And I find that that's more successful when you're using seeds, when you're planting, versus something like a soaker hose, or there's a lot of irrigation that offers water like emission from maybe only 12 inches. So you have a little opening and then it releases water there and then another 12 inches. But if you're planting something like carrots that can be sown every inch or closer, you're kind of missing those plants in between those two emitters. So I really like the spray emitters. and getting the soil soaked from, from the top down to support seeds.
Cherie, we've talked a little bit about getting the soil ready, but once you have the plant in the ground, I'm certain that there are things about each individual plant that they have different requirements. Tomatoes need something different from begonias. So, talk about fertilizers and things to do to keep pests away, or to at least take them down a notch or two.
So, the healthier the soil, the stronger the plant. That's number one. So you really want to start with creating the right type of soil fertility and environment for your plants or your crops, whatever they might be. I usually mulch early and often, meaning to suppress weeds. I don't like to be weeding every other week, so I use a thick layer of mulch around my plants. Like I said, I start with like compost. I compost like a boss, so that's feeding the soil. I try not to add too much amendments to my soil if I don't have to. So that's why the testing is important. You don't want to blind fertilize. That's a big no-no. But you may need some fertilization in your garden, and you can, depending on what you're growing, find some from most big box stores. You can find, blood meal and bone meal. Those things add. Bone meal is really good for, say, tomato plants if you want phosphorus for potassium. So, that's sort of mulching often for the pest control. We're in a pest-friendly environment in North Carolina. And there's many things that you probably want to do. Number one, start with observation. If you have strong plants, they typically can sort of make themselves strong, but you can also plant, companion planting, which can ward off certain plants. But those are dependent on what type of pest you actually have.
So, Mary, when I introduced you at the very beginning of the program and talked about Windcrest Farms, I said that you have nurtured that land organically since 1978. So that says to me, not a lot of pesticides. I don't know what it means for fertilizer, but fill me in.
Okay, zero pesticides in the chemical realm. We do a lot of companion planting, as Cherie had mentioned. And when we set up our gardens in more of a monoculture, all the tomatoes together with no other plants in between, all of the lettuces together, we've just really put up a big billboard for the pests for that particular plant. Here's the buffet, come get it. But if we interplant, let's say, tomatoes with marigolds and parsley and borage and lots of things that are not only going to repel through their aroma or are not food for our pests, but are habitats for beneficials. A lot of people don't realize that a majority of the insects that we see in the garden are beneficial to us. There's just a small percentage that are harmful. And so if we go into the garden with an insecticide, broad spectrum is what you'll see on the label, that's killing everybody. And that is harming the pollination of our plants. That's harming the good guys that are eating the bad guys. So we do a lot of polyculture. So lots of different plants planted together so that they are benefiting each other, not only above the ground, but below the ground.
And both you and Cherie deal with putting things in the actual ground. And we have a question on email. My soil, they say, seems to be mostly Carolina clay. How can I make it better, a better home for plants? And can you get rid of the clay in the soil? And then if you do, what do you use?
You don't want to get rid of the clay. Clay is actually a very good component that holds water and fertility. The problem is the texture. So it doesn't have a lot of drainage. So when that water comes, it stays. And then when it leaves behind basically a red brick. So what we want to do is we want to keep the clay for those components or those benefits, but we want to loosen up the soil. And there are amendments that we can use, but we can also use deep-rooted plants that will break up that soil. We can do crop rotation. Again, that's going to break up that soil to allow for drainage and air. And that's the problem with clay. It's not the clay itself, but the fact that it's so dense that it can block out water and air.
I'm coming to you in a second, Aaron, but as long as we're stuck in the ground, yeah, I'm gonna talk to Cherie for a moment about this. We have another email question who says, I hesitate to use chemicals to get rid of weeds. And since you don't like to weed either, I thought this was a good question for you. But she wants to know if I'm better off plucking them out of flower beds.
Plucking the weeds, yes, you
Yeah.
can pluck. I would, you know, one of the things that we do on our farm is we try not to have a lot of disturbance of the soil. And so we do a lot of cover cropping. We do a lot of covering in the fall and winter, or when we're not growing in our beds, so that those weed seeds aren't depositing. And then in the spring, we unveil it, we sort of terminate the cover crop, and then we plant right into it. If you have weeds in your flower bed, you can pluck them, but just try not to stir up the dormant seeds or bring seeds that are under the soil up. That's one of the things. And then for clay, here my compost thing again, compost like a boss. Clay loves organic matter. Put that in with the clay, and you're going to have wonderful soil. You're going to wish other people are going to envy you that you have clay and that compost in there.
Okay. Aaron, flowers. This applies, I suppose, to people who put them in the ground, also to people who put them in pots on the patio or on the balcony of their apartment. I hear the music. That means I'm not going to have time to get an answer to the question, but I'm going to plant the seed, and then you can think about it during the break and come back and answer it. When most people buy flowers, they buy them in these containers at the big box stores. And they're already sprouted as opposed to buying them from seed. So, when you buy one of those plants, what should you look for to make sure that they don't die the week after you plant them? How do you know that a plant is healthy? We'll take a break. We'll get the answer to that when we come back. We're here with Aaron Hostetler from The Patio Farmer, Cherie Jazar from Deep Roots CPS Farm, and Mary Roberts from Windcrest Farms on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about, excuse me, spring gardening with three people who know it well. Aaron Hostetler, the patio farmer, Cherie Jazar, Deep Roots CPS Farm, and Mary Roberts of Windcrest Farm. So I asked a question, when you go to these big box stores and you buy flowers that are already sprouted in these little containers, quite often you plant them, they die. I'm wanting to know how you can pick out a plant that's healthy, and that you know is healthy, even though it may look peaked because they haven't watered it yet today. How do you know what it is? And when these things die, is it your fault or is it a bad plant? Aaron.
Great questions. Great questions. Well, first of all, as a small business owner, I will give a little encouragement that if you can support a local small business with your plant purchasing, that would be my recommendation for getting high quality plants that are not mass produced. My friend Mary Roberts grows beautiful certified organic plants that you can buy at her farm on Saturdays. But when you're shopping for plants and you're curious, you know, if this plant is healthy, you know, is this the right plant that I should buy? And you are in a big box store, some things that you can keep in mind are the size of the plant, you know, and the container that it's in. So the two together. If the plant looks a lot significantly bigger than the container that it is in, that could be an indication that maybe that plant has outgrown its container by a decent amount of time, and it could be root bound. Another thing that you could look for that would tell you that a plant is root bound, which basically means that its roots are just craving more support, craving more nutrients, is if you pick up a pot and you can see roots coming out of the bottom of the pot. Typically,
But if
you
you're going
know,
to take it
young.
out, if you're going to take it out of the pot, doesn't that solve the root bound problem?
It does give the plant more space for its roots to spread out. But what that's also telling you is that maybe that plant has been a little stressed already in its life. So it could be an indication. It just is an indication of stress on the plant.
So are you?
Also, you know,
Go ahead.
go ahead. Oh, okay. So you did mention flowers and shopping for flowers. So if you're looking for something that's going to bloom, trying to find, you know, maybe you mix and match, you get some plants that have already opened up, their blooms have already opened, or maybe you get some that haven't quite opened. So you get, instead of going home and planting your flowers, which are going to look beautiful, for you know a couple of weeks, but then those flowers might die off. If you get some that are kind of, you know, mixed in the stages of blooming, then you get a more prolonged bloom on your flowers.
Are there flowering plants? I'm not sure which one of you to ask this question, but are there flowering plants that do best here in terms of surviving the heat and the sunshine that we get in the Carolinas in the summer? I mean, is a begonia better than a geranium, or geranium is better than something else? What would you recommend? Mary.
Well, I would. Oh, go ahead,
No,
Mary.
no, go ahead, Erin. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a feeling we might be on the same track here.
No
But
problem.
I would always encourage you to look for native varieties of flowering plants. There's a lot of great websites, or you can look up native flowering plants in North Carolina, and it will give you a list of plants that do really well in our climate.
And given the price of food, everybody is looking for ways to perhaps lower the grocery bill. What vegetables, what fruits seem to do well in the Carolinas? I know zucchini can be a bumper crop every year, and you can't even give it away, you have so much. But what about tomatoes? What about strawberries? What about blueberries? What about other food crops that you would put on the dinner table?
All of those
Sure.
are good, great options. But what I tell people, because sometimes people plant things that other people are planting just because they're planting or that they find at, you know, their home garden center. But you need to really identify the things that you're going to eat first. That's like the first step of the plan. And if you like leafy greens, you want to start right now with putting in leafy greens, spinaches and kales and mustards and collards. If you like tomatoes, if you're going to eat them, they can come in abundance. What are you going to do when you're done slicing them? Are you going to can them? Are you going to make salsa? So really deciding what goes into your garden really is a personal choice, should be, and it really should be what you want to grow. Now, you might like eating bananas. I can tell you it's very difficult and probably almost nearly impossible to grow a banana tree out in your in a raised bed or out in your backyard. So you want to be practical and do some research about what is native. So, but start with what you want to grow and what you want to eat.
If you're dealing with a small space, Aaron, what kinds of fruits, vegetables do well in small spaces, small containers?
Oh man. Well, you know, if someone tells me you can't plant it in a pot, that's the first thing I want to do is plant it in a pot and watch it grow. So I'm a big believer that, you know, whatever you want to grow, you can grow successfully in pots. I have all of my perennial fruit trees, fruit bushes are in large pots. I get tons of blueberries from my blueberry bushes grown in large grow bags every year. It's so much fun to grow those. You know, I think the biggest thing when you're trying to maximize the yields of your space, whether it's small or large, is that, you know, you're really clued into the timing for when things should be planted, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier. And once you have your space set up, even if it's containers and raised beds, there's always something, and we're very lucky that we live in the Carolinas where this is possible, but there's always something that you can be growing and harvesting and eating from that space. So it's, you know, it can be a decent upfront cost to get started, but then the benefits and all of the harvests are just infinite after that.
So Katie asks, how can I get rid of grubs in my soil, both in the ground soil and the bags of raised bed soil? Are there grubs in bags of soil? Really?
Not typically.
Okay.
But I'm happy to answer the grub question because I was talking with a client about this just on Friday. So yeah, grubs are, can be really disturbing when you find them, when you're digging around, you're finding those, especially the Japanese beetle grubs, which might be the ones that Katie has unearthed. But as we all know, Japanese beetles can be very prolific in the Carolinas in the summer. So there's a product that is safe for organic growing. It's called Milky Spore. And you can apply it, typically it's best to apply that in the fall, but you can apply it, I mean, if you're noticing them now, you can certainly apply that now to your soil. It's a granular product and you sprinkle it on the soil. You can mix it in, water it in, but it's a biospecific bacteria that targets grubs in particular. So it's not going to harm any of the other insects, other wonderful members of our soil ecosystems, but it will target specifically those Japanese beetle grubs. So Milky Spore is great to use. And
okay, go ahead. Finish up.
Sorry.
That's okay. Finish up.
Geraniums are great to plant for Japanese beetles in particular. They're kind of a little trap. They attract the beetle, but then the oils and the flowers will kill them.
Assassins. Geranium assassins. Okay, Cherie, it's time for you to step up to the bar because we have a chicken question. And I know that you talk about incorporating wildlife like chickens and goats and even honeybees into your garden. One of our emailers wants to incorporate chickens into their garden. They have no idea how or where to start. Do you have any tips?
Okay, so this is a big one because the price of eggs, everybody's thinking about chickens, right? And chickens are my grub eaters, just so you know. They love to scratch around and they'll get the grubs and it's a lot of protein for them on my farm. So if you are thinking about getting chickens and you're in a residential area, first of all, you need to understand whether you have controls that would regulate chickens, backyard chickens, whether it be from the municipal government, the city, the township, the county, knowing what the policies are for you to get chickens. If you're in a homeowners association, if you have a HOA or property owners association, you need to know the rules then. So that's the first, do your little research, right? Because you don't want to just go out and get chickens and put them in your backyard and then your neighbors start knocking. Or you think you got a little chick that's going to turn into a hen to lay eggs and it's a rooster and it's disturbing everyone, which happens. It happens very often. And on our farm, we rescue little chickens. Somebody calls us and says, we just got the notice. We can't have these chickens. And can you help us get rid of them? And said, sometimes we'll bring them to our farm. We don't do it a lot, but we'll do that.
And I read yesterday that you've been involved in rescuing these chickens from people who have bought them with good intent, but then realized it's so much work or it's too much work or they don't have the right conditions for these animals and you come and get them. So what are the considerations? What are the right conditions? How much time do you have to devote to these animals if you're going to raise them in the backyard?
So you need to have an understanding of the housing that's necessary. So chickens need a chicken coop. They need a run area. And, you know, there's many online forums, backyardchickens.com, that can kind of guide you if you're just starting out to understand what size coop, what size run do I need. So that's one thing. You need the space on your property. Secondly, chickens need to eat. So maybe you need to supplement with a feed. Where do you get that from? What type of feed are you feeding your chickens? They have health, you got to keep them healthy, you got to give them water. It could be a very fun thing for a family to engage with raising chickens and getting eggs from them. But it's time consuming, and you really want to know before you just start out.
Before I run out of time, I also know that you deal with goats and you deal with honeybees. Honeybees, I just saw another news story over the weekend about the collapse of honeybee colonies. It's been going on for years. We're not exactly sure why, but I'll bet you that a lack of certain kinds of wildflowers and pesticides play a big role in all of this. How many people really want to raise these things? Because they seem to be stingy.
Well, that's one of the things. You really got to be passionate about honeybees in order to raise them, right? But there are so many other native bees to North Carolina that you can easily build for mason bees and leaf cutter bees. And that's just taking a block of wood and sort of drilling a hole about 6, 7 inches down near your garden. And that could be a habitat for these native bees, and they could come and they can pollinate. You don't necessarily have to worry about stings because they're not worried about you. They're just worried about doing their job. But honeybees, like I said, there's a passion. There's many, many organizations and associations in our community that can help somebody start their journey for beekeeping.
Climate change, Mary, is making things drier and warmer. And I know that the maps that they publish every year for regional growing areas, everything is beginning to shift toward the north, with certain things that couldn't grow there now able to grow there, and certain things that we used to bank on in the south kind of migrating out. What has, from your personal experience and your professional experience, what has been the impact of climate change so far?
Well, we definitely plan our summers a lot differently as far as what hours of the day we work, so that we don't suffer some heat stresses and we can continue to do what we love to do. We're also looking, and thankfully, there has been for quite a while research on varieties that are adapting to our specific region. To take into account the drier and the temperature changes that we're seeing. So looking at different varieties that we have to adapt that have adapted to these changing conditions has been probably number one for our strategy of looking at this. Now, we do have structures on the farm called high tunnels. They look like greenhouses, but we're actually growing in the ground. And that helps us control the environment to a certain extent, a little bit more artificially. Very low tech, but very effective in for us extending the season or mitigating against too much rain, too dry, having place things in place to help us modify the climate a little bit. But it's definitely hard on the farm workers, I can tell you that, from the farm owner down to the folks that are picking and processing. It's having an effect.
I have about a minute left, and there was an article recently in the New York Times about why gardening is good for you. And first, it pointed out the physical things that are good for you because it takes work. You got to hoe, you got to dig, you got to get out there, and you got to move around. But they say it's also good for your psyche, for your mental health. They quoted Emily Weaver, who's the program manager of therapeutic horticulture at the North Carolina Botanical Garden, who said, excuse me, working with plants, people kind of see where they fit in the world. They see why they're valuable because of the cause and effect relationship that plants so visibly articulate. I've never heard anybody say that before. Would you all agree with that? I have 15 seconds. Would you agree with that, Mary?
Absolutely. It keeps me doing what I do, and it is a labor of love.
Cherie?
Most definitely de-stressor, and it's great for families.
And since you deal with smaller spaces, Aaron, same thing?
Oh, absolutely. That's the reason why I do what I do, Mike.
Okay. Aaron Hostetler gets the last word. She is the local gardener and the owner of the patio farmer. Cherie Jazar is the local gardener, farmer, owner of Deep Roots CPS Farm. We didn't get to talk about goats. And Mary Roberts, the owner of Windcrest Farms. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.